Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Well, it's so nice to have my friend Lena Chern on today. Lena is somebody that I had followed for a long time. We followed each other on social media, back on Twitter and Blue Sky, Instagram, everywhere. And I had the best experience. I had just started working at Poison Pen, and Lena and her son and her mom happened to be in Phoenix. And so she just stopped in, and it was a day where I was working, and she was such a delight. My coworker Jen and I loved meeting you. And yeah, I can't thank you enough. So that's where this friendship kind of started. So Lena, thank you for being here. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. I love your books, your sensibility. You're Chicago based. I feel like, you know, I lived in the Midwest. We kind of have similar sensibilities. I should say that Lena Chern's debut mystery novel, Play the Fool, which you really should pick up, won the 2024 Mary Higgins Clark Award and was nominated for the 2024 Lefty and Anthony Awards. Her shorter work has appeared in Mystery Weekly, the Marlboro Review, the Bellingham Review, Black Fox Literary Magazine, and The Coil. And yes, she does live in Chicago with her family. So Lena, I love that your books are about like a psychic, a woman who, you know, kind of is a con woman, sees the future, doesn't see the future. We don't know. She has to solve a murder. In the first book, she works in a shopping mall. It's such a cool idea. So original. So I'd love to know, how did you get that idea?
Thank you. That's a wonderful intro. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah.
I feel like when we initially had talked about examining movies with psychics, that's just something that's obviously spoke to me very naturally, because obviously my main character, Katie True, while not an actual psychic with powers, is a tarot card reader, and so naturally tends to play with people's belief in the supernatural and predestination.
Yeah.
And that's just something I've always really been interested in. Are events laid out beforehand? Are they random? Or more generally, do events have an actual fixed meaning, or do we create that meaning ourselves? And that idea has always fascinated me, and in a way kind of inspired my books, because before I even thought about writing these books, I did do some amateur tarot card reading, which is a question that I get asked a lot when I talk about my books.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
And I, even though it wasn't very good, there was always a moment when people sort of locked in and were like, oh, that's amazing. That's exactly what's going on in my life. How did you know? Either your magic or the cards are, or something like that. And it was very clear the magic was not coming from me or the cards, but from them.
The applied meaning. Yeah.
Exactly. I feel like the cards, and this is what really fascinates me about tarot cards, the cards sort of tap into our natural tendency to tell stories, even about our own lives. Storytelling is such a deep and basic human trait. We're sort of faced with this random universe that we have to make sense of and impose some sort of order or meaning onto. And that's just kind of what we do naturally. The cards just tend to focus people's natural tendency to do that. So I feel like that's what I knew at that point that I had hit on something really important. I just didn't really know exactly what it was. And then years later, when I, when I was writing these novels, all of that experience kind of came up for me, and I started thinking about it a little bit more deeply.
Yes, absolutely. I really enjoyed talking to you about your follow-up book, Tricks of Fortune. Over the summer, we did an interview on behalf of Poison Pen virtually as part of Lena's book tour. You can find that interview on the Poison Pen store channel podcast as an audio file, or you can also watch it on YouTube as a video as well. So if you want to learn more specifically, although we had so much fun talking that I remember us randomly going a million different directions. We talked about our love of Wonder Boys and all kinds of stuff. So it was a blast. Yes.
Yes. Yes, it was. I loved that.
Yeah. So how was writing the second book? Because that usually people go back and forth on, like, I had to teach myself to write the book all over again, or the second one's harder. What did you think?
Yeah, all of the above, please. I really did kind of struggle with the second book and kept my publisher was very generous in giving me
Oh.
all the extra time I needed. And of course, the cliche is you have your whole life to write your debut. The sec, you know, if you're lucky enough to get a publisher, they want it on a schedule. So
Yes.
yeah, the turning around a book in 1 year, that just did not happen for me. I think it probably took 2 or 3 years all told.
It's okay. We kind of had a pandemic situation that was going on. So I think you're forgiven there.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So are we going to see Katie True again in the future?
I would certainly hope so. I have some ideas of where she can go. She and her motley crew of companions can go next. We're
Yes.
kind of up in the air at this point on what the plans are, but I certainly hope so.
Yeah. No, I think we covered some of the stuff in the Poison Pen interview, but for those who are new to you here, what is your background? Did you always want to be a writer? How did you first get into it?
I did always want to be a writer. I remember wanting to be a writer ever since I was a kid. I was a huge reader. My dad had a huge library, primarily of science fiction books. So I kind of grew up reading science fiction, all these wonderful tattered old paperbacks, you know, that smell like bookstores. And I think probably the biggest influence on my wanting to be a writer were these giant tomes of Hugo Award winners that my dad had just lying around.
Yes.
So I just like barreled through those and was exposed to a lot of different kind of styles and themes. And it really kind of helped me, I think, feel like it kind of set the stage for my sort of omnivorous reading
Yes.
palette later in life. And I always kind of tried to make a go of it. For a while, I was writing poetry. That's sort of what I studied in college.
Yeah.
I think mostly because I thought shorter pieces would somehow be easier to write. Spoiler alert, they were not. And I think,
No, you need the right sentence or the right phrase. Yes.
yeah, it's actually harder. It's
Yeah.
harder in a lot of ways, but I also feel like writing poetry, not to go off on an aside, really kind of helped me appreciate
Yes.
writing sort of on the word and sentence level.
Yes.
And that's something that I still very much obsess over, even though I now write long form prose. I'm very interested in how the prose sounds. That's sort of one of my
Yeah.
delights in writing.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about it. I did the same. I think like the first poem I wrote was like in college and they did publish it in the magazine and stuff, but it like you, it was like, you know, after that it's hard to get it or you have such high standards and it's a difficult medium, but I do remember loving, this was around the time also I got really into Elmore Leonard and the way
Oh,
things
yes.
sounded. And so whenever I would write, especially dialogue, I'd have to read everything out loud.
Yes.
And which is something I guess like Jeffrey Deaver and a bunch of authors do. They do read it out loud because there's going to be things you miss. You're like, that doesn't sound good. And some of them
Absolutely.
tap out the rhythm of things. So I do love that. And I can see that in your book. You're so descriptive, which I really appreciate.
Thank you. Yeah, and Elmore Leonard, as I know we've talked about, is absolutely one of my favorite
Yeah.
writers. And he's actually one, he was actually sort of the big revelation for me that sort of led me to crime fiction. And it was that particular sort of sharpness to his prose that I think really drew me in. And I think maybe this is what you meant, but he also was very famous for reading his work out loud. Like he would
Yes.
get calls from agents or whatever and just be like, okay, listen to this, and just read them a piece of his writing on the phone. I just love that.
Yeah. And I think this is cool because your subject matter with the psychic and some of the ideas of intuition and stuff kind of go naturally from, okay, you have crime, but you have a little of that sci-fi that you grew up reading as well. And then probably from playing around with tarot, you sort of developed more of an interest, which I enjoy. I remember when I started this blog, it was in college, like around 2000. Six or so, for film intuition. And it was like a female filmmakers class. So I just went with film intuition for female intuition.
Oh,
You
okay.
have no idea how many, like for the first few years, I was getting inquiries about crystals and Reiki and tarot because of the phrase intuition. And I thought about changing it because it was just a class project that kind of took off. But then I'm like, you know what? I like this idea of being intuitive about film and
Yeah.
seeing things in it. And so I feel like we kind of had similar paths with that. And then we just apply it to our medium. So I'm really excited about this subject today.
Oh, thank you. And what a great little background piece of information to know where that phrase came from. I'd always kind of wondered. I mean, it almost seemed
Yeah.
like a natural fit, but it's interesting to see where it came from.
Yeah. I know. I get asked that all the time. Like, what's with that? It's like, I was just going with, you make a list of like 10 things and yeah, it's a play on female intuition. So that's where
Nice.
that came from. I think it was the weirdest site originally. It was just mostly about movies directed by women. And then I did my noir class. And so then it was like fully noir. So it was
Oh,
just the
okay.
weirdest. And then it just became everything, essentially. Yeah, which it does. You sort of find your way. And like you said, go to long form prose, or I'm going more to essays and stuff. But yeah, I think it was cool because one of the things I love about this, I love talking to authors and writers, critics, people who are really into their craft and love writing. But I learn something new every time. It's like taking a different film survey course, like depending on what you want to talk about and the movies that you choose. And so I remember we were going for everything from like, what about shopping malls? What about this? And then, psychics, and predestination and free will and fate. I just thought that is so fun. And we have not really covered that. We've talked about some of these movies tangentially, like The Dead Zone we're going to bring up. That is one that I recommended on the recent Stephen King episode with S.A. Cosby and William Boyle. But other than that, yeah, I think the sky is the limit. So did you
Wonderful.
always like these movies? Were some of these you just were going off of stuff you heard when you chose them?
Well, kind of both. I have four movies, and one of them I've always loved ever since I saw it in the theater. That's Minority Report.
Yes.
And the other ones are really, those were just kind of always out there, but I had never really seen them. And honestly, there were so many other choices when I was putting this list
Yeah.
together, but I felt like, and I kind of tried on a few and watched a bunch of stuff, and it seemed like not all of them really kind of fit exactly what I was trying to say,
Yeah.
I guess. Although there's definitely, it's this is such a this turned out to be such a wide topic, and there's so many angles to look at it from that I kind of had to narrow in on exactly what I was going for. So that's sort of where this final list came about. So it's I have minor in no particular order: Minority Report, The Dead Zone, which you had just mentioned, The Gift, which actually I had never heard of before. That was a nice
Okay.
recommendation, and the red. I don't even know what the official title of this movie is.
Yeah,
Is it
Three
Three Colors
Colors
Red?
Red. Yes,
Okay.
that was me. I will make everyone watch that. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, wonderful. And of course, I was aware of this trilogy. I remember seeing Blue when I was in college, right around the time
Yeah.
that these movies came out. I haven't seen White, but I really remember responding to Blue. And so I was excited to watch this one. And I can't thank you enough for recommending it, because
Oh,
I
of
feel like
course.
it's sort of an outlier on this list, but in some way it really kind of ties up exactly what I was thinking of when I first started thinking about this topic.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad that you loved it. There are a lot of other options that we were throwing around. I had covered a few. Nightmare Alley, of course, is phenomenal. I like the old one and the newer one by Guillermo del Toro. I did an episode on Nightmare Alley with my coworker, Patrick Milliken from Poison Pen, a year ago. We compared it to the novel and got all nerdy, and it was fun. I also talked about Stir of Echoes with my friend Elizabeth Cantwell in an episode. So we had touched a little bit on some of those, and I liked this idea. We were also throwing around Only You, which we both adore. It's a great romantic comedy by Norman Jewison with Robert Downey Jr. and Marissa Tomei. I might have actually talked about it on a Downey Jr. episode in retrospect, but in the end, it's like we didn't have quite as much to dig into as the rest of these movies. So I like the list that you came up with.
Oh, wonderful.
All right, where do you want to start?
I'm going to go ahead and start with Minority Report because
Yeah.
that's the movie that I'm sort of the most familiar with.
Yes.
I just love this. I saw it and I remember seeing it in the theaters when it came out, and it's kind of lived in my head ever since then. I always like to examine the source material. This movie is obviously based on a 1956 short story by Philip K. Dick. Which I had not read before. I had read it in preparation for this. And by the way, this is another thing, like comparing different interpretations of the same source material is absolutely my jam. I feel
Oh, I
like
love
it,
it. Yeah.
oh yeah, it in a weird way, it kind of dovetails with what we're talking about here. It really highlights the role of the storyteller in the story,
Yeah.
sort of creating slash imposing meaning on existing events or plot points or something like that. It was really interesting. The original story kind of outlines the basic concept that we now know as Minority Report, the movie,
Yeah.
but the movie is really about 80% original. All
Okay.
the glossy kind of action movie stuff and also some of the more interesting kind of touching human aspects are absolutely a creation of Steven Spielberg and his team.
Yeah.
And this is another one of those things where like it's rare, but I feel like an instance of the movie being far better than the original story.
Yes, I agree with you. I had read this story way, way back too. I didn't get a chance to see this one in the theater and I regret it because I had just had another spine surgery, but I remember watching it and just being fascinated. For me, it seemed like Spielberg was still, and he was, he had just made AI, for his idol, his mentor, Stanley Kubrick. And I feel like he was still in that mindset because when you watch this film, you're like, this does not feel like a Steven Spielberg movie, which is interesting. I do love that he is willing to try these things. He wanted to make it look as noir as possible. He told Janusz Kaminski, his cinematographer, to make it the grittiest, the dirtiest film he'd ever shot. And so I think it looks like noir, but it also looks a little like those neorealist, Italian movies after World War II, where they were just like on newsreel footage, like old grimy footage they were recording on because it was cheap. So, it's purposely washed out. It's almost black and white. It's a little bright, a little hard on the eyes at times. I'm a little bit sensitive to lights. I had a weird concussion like 10 years ago. Our
Oh my goodness.
washing machine leaked and I had no idea. And I walked full out down the
Oh
hallway and just slid and then banged my head twice on the door. And
no.
yeah, and so I like haven't been able to watch 3D since then, which kind of was hard as a critic. And certain like flashing lights will get to me. So there are some lights, but overall, this one was okay. So I don't know how photosensitive some of the people are, but just warning you. But yeah, I feel like this is Spielberg in Kubrick mode, in Kubrick noir mode, which makes sense. So I'm sure he watched, The Killing and all of those. Yeah.
That's interesting that you say that about how the movie looks, because that's definitely something that when I think about this movie in my mind, I kind of see it. One of the
Yeah.
things that I that really stayed with me was how it looked, that sort of whitish kind of
Yeah.
pale, but at the same
Anesthetic.
time
Yeah.
dark kind of,
Yeah.
And another thing that's really kind of interesting about this movie is how well it holds up technology-wise.
Oh my gosh, I know. Some of this stuff happened. Yes. He did talk to scientists and people in computers and was like, I don't want it to be so bogus. Like, and I think going that extra mile really paid off. Yeah.
Well, I think it came out, let's see, when was it, 2002? Was
Yes.
that? And I remember seeing it at the time and thinking how cool that whole touchscreen thing was, because at the time
Yes.
that wasn't available at all.
Yeah.
Now it's kind of like it's hard to remember that that wasn't around back then. Like now it looks very natural because that's just how we, all the Avengers movies, all
Yeah.
that stuff now use it just kind of as a matter of course. But at the time it was very new. And it's funny because certain things are very, very on point and other things are have that sort of like the past thinking
Yeah.
about the future kind of thing, where people have these, these amazing sort of touchscreen technology things, but they're still like reading newspapers or they're still
Yes.
payphones. This was before iPhones and all that stuff. So it's kind of an interesting amalgam of technological ideas.
And I feel like, he was really going for that, like Kubrick would do that. Of course, the 2001, it wound up inspiring the space program a little bit and getting them a little suspicious about how did he know that NASA was working on some of this stuff. And I also just think, I feel a little like, even though it is a crime story and a thriller and a murder, it is so plot heavy. I had forgotten the amount of stuff that Scott Frank, rewriting that older script managed to do. And, he's great at that. He writes wonderful mysteries. I love The Lookout and Out of Sight and some of his other films. But it also sort of feels like it's touching on 1984 and Fahrenheit 9/11 or Fahrenheit 451. And so I do appreciate that. Yeah,
Yeah, definitely.
it's an unusual mix. Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of a it touches on, yeah, exactly. It sort of fires on all cylinders. It appeals to a lot of like different things
Yes.
that you want in a movie. They're all kind of here. It's a very complete movie, it feels like.
Yes, and spoiler alert, I had forgotten the whole twist thing involving Colin Farrell, Farrell and Max von Sydow. Is that or Sydow? I had forgotten the twist. It kind of felt like that scene in L.A. Confidential with Rollo Tomasi at the table. It was like, oh my gosh. Yes. So I loved that. I had seen this a couple times, but it had been a long time. So I appreciated getting another opportunity to take a look at it. I remember being really confused the first time because, I was like, wait a minute, that's her mom and that's her, like, it was a lot of information to pack in there. But I feel like, you watch it again and you're maybe less losing yourself in the technology that time and paying more attention, more focus. And yeah, I think this would be really better on repeat viewings. What did you think of all the actors?
Oh, I mean, I love them. I think they're all really amazing. And Tom Cruise, say whatever you will about his
Oh
personal
gosh,
life,
yeah.
he's amazing in this movie. And there's, not to give too much away, but there's a very climactic scene at the end where that really, I should probably say this for later because it's sort of like the crown jewel in kind of this movie's examination of like free will versus predetermination. But
Yeah.
there's a very this in this movie comes down hard on the side of free will. It's really, and they do such a nice job of carrying that theme through, even better than the original story. But there's a scene at the end that I don't want to give too much away, but it's the scene where Tom Cruise's character, John Anderton, who's sort of the chief of this pre-crime department that, for those who aren't familiar with this movie, that anticipates murders before they happen and stops the murders. So once he kind of is targeted by this system and has to figure out what to do, he is eventually faced with the person that he is going to kill, and he has to decide whether or not to kill him. And
Yeah.
the scene of him finally making that
Oh
decision,
my
sort of in
gosh.
tears, is
Yes.
just amazing.
Yeah, it just grabs. Oh my gosh. You're so invested. The way that he can register like conflicting emotions on his face, I think is incredible. I always thought he was a much better actor than the material he was given a lot or and the credit that he doesn't really get the credit he deserves. I was glad that they gave him an Academy Award. It was also cool, something I didn't realize, Spielberg doesn't take salaries. He takes portions of the gross for each movie to make sure the budget is kept down. So in order to keep the budget at 100 million, a Minority Report, he talked Tom Cruise into doing the same. Like, you're not getting a salary, you'll get the gross. So he said, if they're coming on this journey with me, I want them to gamble too, like that the movie will be good and people will catch on. And I feel like he was really kind of taking a lot of risks in this era. I love The Terminal. It's a movie everyone overlooks. I met the
I don't know that one.
screenwriter for The Terminal. Did you see that one with
No, I didn't.
Tom Hanks? Oh my gosh, he gets stuck in an
Oh.
airport.
Yes. I'm familiar. I haven't seen it, but I'm familiar with the
Yeah,
movie.
I think that might be my mom's favorite Spielberg movie, honestly. I love Catch Me If You Can, which came out I think around 2000, 2001. So right
Yeah.
before this, AI, of course, was a change of pace for him too. And this led into, I didn't love War of the Worlds. And, there were a lot of issues with, what is it? The Crystal Skull, Indiana Jones that people had.
Sure.
But, then it led to like Munich, which is phenomenal. So I do think he was trying to go outside the expected, kind of like how he
Yeah.
did with Schindler's List too. So this showed
Yeah.
him really taking chances, which I love.
I would absolutely agree with all of that. I guess another, speaking of performances, another a really, really interesting, really powerful performance in this movie is, oh my gosh, what is her name? The young lady who played Agatha, the female
Oh, Samantha
Kreekaw, I guess they call
Morton.
it, Samantha
Yeah,
Morton.
I know. I had only seen her really in, I think, a movie called Trixie and then Sweet and Lowdown. That was about it.
She is, and that's a really, really interesting way in which this movie diverges from the source material, because the way they, honestly, the way they sort of handle the whole treatment of the precogs in the story is kind of gross, and it's
Yeah,
very
Philip K.
dated,
Dick
and
will get very,
yeah, it's
like Paycheck. I kind of love that movie, the John Woo one, Paycheck,
Yeah.
with Ben Affleck. But, when we see some of these Philip K. Dicks and they're like sticking things in their head and going down, it's a lot.
It is, and it really sort of it sort of brushes the this movie really sort of puts the it sort of puts the psychics, the precogs, kind of it really kind of examines what the human toll is of having this power. Again, the original story kind of treats them as these drooling morons that are barely human. In the movie, Agatha is sort of a major character whose own story ends up being very significant. It's sort of interwoven into the plot. And they really do such a visceral job of showing kind of the human toll of this power, the horror of seeing these murders over and over, sort of the exploitative system that kind of feeds on these visions. And she really sort of expresses all of that really well. And she is also the one who, the movie's called Minority Report. The Minority Report, for again, for anybody who's not familiar, is sort of the generally the three precogs are aligned on what's going to happen in the future, except that every once in a while the female one, the more powerful one, will produce this sort of minority report, and that's which is sort of the evidence of an alternate future and the possibility of choice and free will. And that's why her character is so central here. She's sort of the one who's always telling John to that he has a choice, he has free will, that he needs to run. The other thing that I really found interesting about this movie is not only is it called for this, is titled for this idea of free will, but there's a very important line in it that comes up all the time, and it's everybody runs. And in fact, I think I think they even used it on the as a tagline on the posters at some point. And it's just this idea that every potential murderer tries to fight their predestined fate. The idea of running comes up a lot. It sort of becomes this metaphor of exercising your free will, of sort of fighting this idea of predestination, that you always have a choice. So I just think that's really interesting. And she sort of becomes the central figure that is kind of that kind of represents this choice.
Absolutely. It's a great chase movie. And Elvis Mitchell from the New York Times actually contemporaneously said, the picture looks as if it were shot on chrome, caught on the fleeing bumper of a late 70s car. And I love that because it really does. Like, they're running. Everybody loves to watch Tom Cruise run. But this is kind of a big chase movie. I like how it begins sort of, and there's allusions to conducting and it's very operatic. The first 14-minute sequence is completely compelling. But then as it continues, you're in a chase movie. You're in a, Wrong Man, Hitchcock, North by Northwest kind of thing.
But it's also funny how the chase sequences, like you were talking about how this movie was really sort of a departure for Spielberg in a lot of ways, and it is. And then there are some touches during the chase scenes in particular that are so Spielberg, like when he crashes through the building and the family is like, "What's this?" And
Yeah, that's
the
only Spielberg for sure.
absolutely. So it's just It's just a joy to watch. It's just so entertaining and so well plotted and well acted. It's a terrific movie.
It is. Is there anything else you wanted to add to it, or you want to move on to the next one?
No, I feel like I've kind of
Yeah.
said what I wanted to say about it.
All right.
The one I watched after Minority Report was The Dead Zone.
And this was a first time watch for you, right? David Cronenberg, we're talking about the 1983 version, which I had never seen either until like a couple years ago in the pandemic and was completely taken in by it. It's very episodic, and it's, he can see a little of the past or the future, or and realizes that the dead zone is like we do have the possibility to alter the future. Christopher Walken's phenomenal. I love Brooke Adams. Really good cast. So what did you think? And of course it's Cronenberg. But it's Cronenberg not working from a script he wrote, which is unusual. And it's him, not, it was filmed in Canada, but there's not any of the Canadian aspects that you would expect because it is strictly, Castle Rock, Maine. Stephen King. Yep.
I had not seen this movie either until just now, although I did a long time ago read the novel it was based on.
Okay.
And so it was interesting to see it kind of brought to the screen. Really great movie. I really enjoyed it a lot. It's interesting that this one also, just like Minority Report, the title actually refers to, once again, the possibility of choice, free will.
Yes.
And that's something that runs through all of these movies. Let's see. I really like the feel of this movie. I feel like there's something very sort of quiet about it, almost sort of lyrical. Like
Yes,
there's
that's a really good point.
Yeah, and it's sort of which it really sort of brings in some of Stephen King's lyricism, like all of the allusion, the poetry that Christopher Walken's character reads, Edgar Allan Poe, all of these sort of it's just a very and we're seeing sort of a quieter Christopher Walken, although there is one moment when he smashes a lamp. It almost feels like they're like, come on, dude, you gotta give us something. You gotta
Yeah, you gotta
give us some
walken it
there's some
up a little bit.
yeah,
Yeah. And I
exactly.
heard around the time they were actually thinking of hiring like Michael Cimino, who had directed him in The Deer Hunter. And I thought, well, that would have been a different performance, for that director. But I really
Very
like that
much.
it wound up with Cronenberg. I guess Stephen King really wanted Bill Murray. But they didn't get Bill Murray. King wrote a
Interesting.
script that Cronenberg and other people agree was maybe the worst script they'd ever read. So I don't
Oh,
know if
no.
he was too close to his own material, I think, and it was too dour. It was hard to pack so much plot into the film because I guess there's like a brain tumor and stuff that happens in the book that isn't in the film, and so they did have to kind of tone it down. And once the screenwriter came up with the idea of like episodes or different little sections,
Yeah.
that's what they stuck with. I did not expect it to head into like Parallax View Taxi Driver territory. I remember
Yeah.
being surprised. How about you?
Yeah, that's the episodic part of it was really interesting. I feel like it's sort of set up in this very logical way where he has these sort of challenges of increasing importance, with increasing
Yeah.
personal risk. And I feel like that's something that's sort of the focus of this movie. It does also sort of consider the idea of having free will in the face of the impending future, but it kind of focuses more on personal responsibility. Like, what do you do with this? It's obviously focuses on the psychic as the main character. So it really concerns itself kind of like with the idea of what kind of responsibility do you have with this power, even in the face of personal risk? He starts off with this very small sort of task of he in the hospital while he's recovering from the coma that gives him this power. He saves the nurse's daughter from a fire. And then, eventually he solves a murder, almost getting killed in the process. He saves the life of this boy that he's tutoring, even though he, alienates his dad and loses his job and all that stuff. And then eventually we get to this point where he has to figure out whether or not to avert global catastrophe, in the form of this sort of
Yes.
crooked politician that is gonna, it has a very Cold War feel, like, oh, he's gonna press the red button. What do we do? Kind of thing. It's interesting because this movie has kind of an ambivalent take on the idea of predestination. I feel like there's a theme that kind of comes up a lot in Stephen King's work where the sort of idea of like, don't mess with things that are not to be messed with.
Yes, a respect for how life goes. Yes.
The character, for example, the character of the doctor played by Herbert Lom, who's this sort of, he becomes this sort of like wise advisor sort of figure for the Christopher Walken character. And there's a point at which, Christopher Walken tells him that the doctor's mother, who he had always believed had been killed during the Holocaust, was actually alive, or during World War II. I'm not sure if it was Holocaust related or not. And so now this character has the choice of contacting her or not, and he decides not to. And he says it's just better not to know. It's almost like leave the past in the past kind of
Yes.
thing. Even though eventually the movie does come down on the side of changing the future in order to avert some kind of, mass catastrophe, it also sort of comes down on the side of leaving things that are already established kind of where they are. And it's something, I feel like that's something that Stephen King kind of examines a lot in books like Pet Sematary, or even the JFK book, whose name I can't remember because it's a date.
Yes, I think it's for the 22nd of 62 or 63. I think so. It's really interesting to see the cast that shows up for these movies too. Like you've got Martin Sheen. I rewatched a bunch of Stephen King movies in anticipation for the recent episode, and one of them was Firestarter. I watched that after because Bill was saying he was rewatching it for the first time since childhood and he was enjoying it. And I did the same. And one thing I noticed that was cracking me up, it seems like everybody was in this movie. And I kept watching and reading, and the credits just started to make me laugh. Like Mr. Patton himself, George C. Scott is here, plus T.J. Hooker era, Heather Locklear, the dude from Apocalypse Now, Martin Sheen, and the nurse from Cuckoo's Nest. And so I think this is such a ripe time for good Stephen King adaptations. And this one kind of showed they can be classy. I mean, we'd had The Shining and stuff, and we had Carrie, but actually it was Roger Ebert said it was maybe his favorite of the recent the ones that had been done so far. And I think you're right. It's quieter, which is probably why we don't talk about it much. There was another one in the 80s that I watched that I had never seen before. Silver Bullet. Did you see that one? About
I've
the
heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
Oh, you would love it. It's about Corey Haim is a kid in a wheelchair and they think there's a werewolf. His sister's Megan follows, so it's very, oh my God, it's Anne of Green Gables. And there's a child, like an adult looking back on childhood, all the Stephen King kind of things you see in like Stand By Me and yeah. And so I do appreciate it. I think this was such a good era for Stephen King. And so The Dead Zone, I think also it's a sad movie. It's
Very sad.
very, very melancholy. He has kind of a weird relationship with disability and illness. Sometimes that's grotesquery and sometimes it's stuff happens. And so I do feel like this is a really it's very respectful in that way, and it does show you like also what the responsibility would be with this.
Yeah, I feel like this movie kind of comes to the same conclusion that a lot of these movies do, which is that sort of the essence of being human is the uncertainty, the questioning, sort of the experience, even when you know what the destination is going to be. Because, in a way, we all kind of know what the final destination is. It's going to end the same way for all of us, but we kind of keep living anyway and make choices
Kinda,
and try to be the best people we can be. And that's kind of all you can do.
yeah, and don't tempt fate, don't mess with yes, stuff like that. Yeah, exactly. Things work out. People make decisions, I think. He loves it's very Twilight Zone. He loves the character making a decision and then it pays off the opposite way. Like the end of The Mist. Oh my God, something like that. Yes.
Oh, that was, yeah, I, that's still, I still think
Oh my
about
gosh.
that ending.
Yes. So he loves doing that. He likes the surprise. And so I'm really glad that you saw The Dead Zone. Did you have anything else you wanted to add about it, or should we go on to, is it The Gift was next?
Yes, we can go ahead and go on to The Gift. This is another one that I hadn't seen before. So thank you for the recommendation. Kate Blanchett plays Annie, a card reader in a small Georgia town. Now it's interesting, kind of, that she doesn't read traditional tarot cards. She reads these cards that I don't know exactly. They look to me like the cards that they used to use in like tests of psychic ability.
Yeah,
Like
they're
they're.
very strange. I know Billy Bob Thornton was, and Tom Epperson wrote the script. It was actually written before Sling Blade, which is crazy. But it was based on the alleged psychic experiences of Billy Bob Thornton's mom. So
Interesting.
I'm wondering if those were the cards, maybe. But yeah, this one was interesting because I remember seeing it in the theater. My brother loved it. He had a big crush on Katie Holmes at the time. And so I saw it a few times back in the day, had not seen it again. I think it's a little convoluted, a little too many Southern stereotypes stuff going on. But I do think, just like Minority Report, if you love complicated plots, this is one that has such a complicated plot. And all of these great actors, sometimes in bit parts where they're not doing much. There was a joke yesterday about William H. Macy in Train Dreams, which I haven't watched yet. And it was like amount of time on screen, and it was a graph, and it was barely impact of time on screen. And it was a huge, yes, like, he's in there and he makes that impact. And so I think that's what happens with the cast on this one, too.
And absolutely. I think actually Giovanni Ribisi
Yes, I love
plays.
him. Yeah.
Oh goodness. I feel like he really steals this movie. Like
Yes. He's
he
the
kind of starts
heart
off
of
as
it. Yeah.
he really is. He starts off as this sort of side character who you don't really think anything much is going to happen with, and then really ends up being very central. And he has probably not only is his performance as someone who's kind of struggling with mental illness and all these
Yeah.
demons in his past really, really good, but there's a really, really ugly scene in this movie where he
Oh,
kind of
God.
ends up, dealing with his childhood
Trauma,
trauma.
yeah.
That's very, very powerful. But yeah, just a really, really powerful cast, a really sort of a dreamy feel to it, kind of this.
Yeah.
They're going for this southern sort of almost southern gothic kind of feel. Lots of slow scenes of lush nature, this kind of atmospheric kind of feel. But at the same time, these sort of thriller slash horror elements with all the jump scares and visions and not knowing what's real. I thought it was a really exciting, very watchable, well-plotted movie. I did not guess the whodunit at the end. I was just they.
No, yeah, they
Do some
really
really,
did trick you. And also, think of the time it was released and what he had been in. You would not see it coming, which was really clever. Yeah, I remember, I have one of those moms who can solve any, she should be like Columbo. And so the first time she watched it in 5 minutes, she's like, "That's the person." And I'm like, "What?"
Oh my God.
And it was obnoxious. So I don't like watching mysteries sometimes with her because she solves them too quickly. But
Oh
I
no.
was completely, the wool pulled over my eyes too. We should say it also stars, yeah, we have Keanu Reeves, Greg Kinnear, Hilary Swank, a really good cast. I feel like some of them weren't maybe used the best, but they were maybe just showing up for the plot and for the company of each other. Sam Raimi directed it. Sam Raimi had directed A Simple Plan with Billy Bob Thornton a couple of years earlier, which I love that film. It was shot in Minnesota, where I'm from. And yeah, so that's just dark and beautiful. This one was shot by Jamie Anderson, who had done the cinematography on Gross Point Blank and stuff like Unlawful Entry. He also must have really clicked with Billy Bob because then he did Bad Santa a couple years later. So, yeah, exactly. So it's kind of funny to see the people work with the same colleagues that they like. Yeah, I think this one does kind of go back to the same well a couple too many times with abuse and stereotypes and stuff. But I think for what it is, if you're just watching like a pot boiler on a Saturday night, it does play well. Yeah.
That's interesting that you bring that up about stereotypes. I kind of had noticed that as well. I think something the angle that this movie takes that some of the others don't, which I thought was kind of interesting, was that they kind of explore sort of social attitudes about the idea of predestination and psychics and their gifts. And it's interesting. They kind of, it brings up this, that people have this really sort of uncomfortable love-hate relationship with this idea of predestination and with the people who provide the information about it. It's like we want to know the future. That's why we go to psychics and readers and advisors, but we struggle when we don't really like what we hear and we tend to shoot the messenger.
Oh, that's a
For
really
me,
good
that's,
point.
like for me, that's very much what this movie is about. Like, Keanu Reeves, our beloved Keanu Reeves, it's kind of interesting to
Ugh,
see
he's a
him play this
dirtbag.
really, this kind of horrible, abusive, he plays the husband of one of Annie's clients. And of course, he kind of goes off the deep end and starts blaming or threatening Annie when she tries to protect, the Hilary Swank character, calls her a witch and a Satanist and all this stuff. He's really pretty terrifying. But yeah, this movie really kind of brings up this sort of like age-old misogyny surrounding the
Yeah, it
idea of
really
psychic
leans in
abilities.
there. Also, you made such a good point about, shooting the messenger and advisors, and we turn to them. In this film, I feel like more than the others, people treat her kind of like a therapist almost. Like it's a sacred thing. Like I have to go to the psychic. I have to get these answers or just talk it out. It might just also be somewhere, especially for Swank, to go a few peaceful minutes that aren't as peaceful because she's really trying to help her. Like, dude, you got to get away from this guy.
I think I wrote down this quote and now I can't remember which character said it, but it says, people believe but don't believe. When there is nothing else, they ask anyway. So yeah, you really get the sense that she kind of she's providing this sort of valuable service to the town. And at one point, the Giovanni Ribisi character tells her, you are the soul of this town. You need to keep doing what you're doing. And she's probably the one character in this movie that is sort of, unequivocally good. She really cares about everyone and tries to help them.
Billy Bob definitely has like a Boo Radley obsession of somebody who maybe is on the spectrum or has mental illness or something, and they are protective or they go to those primal instincts to protect or to help. And so it's interesting to see that play out here writing this. And I wonder if it in the back of his mind then was like he led to writing Sling Blade. Of course, he wrote, One False Move. He's a great writer. But it's interesting that all of that kind of was around the same time.
I just have to bring up the one thing that is speaking, going back to the stereotypes issue, the one thing I really did not like about this movie is that even though it tries to kind of expose sort of this misogyny and the way that Annie is kind of humiliated in the courtroom and kind of discredited and all this stuff, the legal system kind of has its way with her. But and all of that is it almost sort of touches on this darker, more general idea of women not being believed when they tell their stories. But I will say that the one trope that I feel like this movie sort of gleefully engages in that I did not like was this sort of idea of the Katie Holmes character
Oh,
being like
yeah,
the
just
town
the
slut that
town
gets
slut.
killed.
It was like, oh, she's no good. She got what she deserved. She's sleeping with everyone. That was a little like 6 degrees of, is she just, how does she schedule this? I don't know. It's like every man
I
in the
know.
vicinity. And we only know of the ones we saw in the movie. I mean, this character, the way she was treated, was like, anybody. And it was
And it's
definitely Katie Holmes trying to like show, hey, I'm grown up and I can play all these things. But it's a bad character.
Is a bad character. And it's funny because at one point Annie's talking to Hilary Swank character, the battered wife, and they very much have this conversation that I think is meant to distract us. Like the lady says, oh, I feel bad. I feel like, I'm having unchristian thoughts. I feel like she deserved it. And Annie says, well, no one deserves that. So we're supposed to take that at face value, but then the movie is telling us something different. I don't like that at all.
I know. There's a definite misogyny in this one that I think I maybe felt, but not fully. When you get older and you've been through life and then you watch it again, you're like, so you always see things differently with time and age. And
Yeah.
then moving on to Three Colors Red, you said you had seen Blue in college and loved it. Were you familiar at all with like the plot?
I was not.
Okay, good. I love that you just
Yeah.
went in. Yeah.
I just went in completely blind and oh my goodness, did I love this movie? I just feel like of this whole list, it's at the same time the vaguest on the subject of predestination. There are no
Yeah.
overt psychics or magic of any kind, but I feel like it's the one that sort of sums up what I personally feel about this subject kind of the most closely, the most clearly. It's like, so I guess I looked up a little bit about it on the internet, and
Yeah.
this was actually really funny. I looked this up on Wikipedia to get a few facts about it, and they categorize it as, quote, a romantic psychological drama mystery art film, which is just like,
A bunch
just
of
made me laugh out
gibberish,
loud.
yeah.
Yeah, just say you don't know what this movie is, or just call it,
Yes.
a film.
Yeah, an art film would work, yeah. Or a foreign film. Yeah, this is the, if anyone is listening and unaware, Krzysztof Kieślowski, is a Polish filmmaker. He made the Decalogue, which is amazing. The Ten Commandments, all the different movies. They were released as a series on Polish television, but then also some of the longer ones, like Story About a Killing, or that's longer. Then he made these. Well, he also made Double Life of Veronique. But he also made this trilogy, and this was the final film that he completed. He did Blue, which is about Juliette Binoche and her husband, who was a composer, passing away, and her journey into grief and also claiming who she is. White is a quality of a husband. Carol Carroll, I think was his name, and his beautiful wife, Julie Delpy, who loved kind of, using him. And so that was about, revenge and equality. And then this one was, Irene Jacob, and it is, again, those French revolutionary ideas, and it also stars, Jean-Louis Trintignant. I think I can't say his name correctly, but yes, this one is beautiful. It is heralded as his masterpiece. I agree. It's one of my like five favorite movies for sure. I saw it when it came out. I was watching those like at home. We would go rent them because Roger Ebert, they were just raving about them all the time. And I had a great experience a couple of years ago. It was 2022. I saw that it was playing. I wanted to go to LA anyway, and I saw that it was playing at the American Cinematheque, the Santa Monica, really the Arrow, the pretty theater. And so I decided I'm booking my trip there. So I
Oh,
completely bought
nice.
the ticket and booked my trip there. And I was going to bring a date, but then he got a gig in a different country, so he
Oh.
couldn't make it. But my friend Courtney Howard, who writes for Variety and Fresh Fiction, she's like, I'll go. And I don't think she had seen it either. And it was just the most beautiful. We're walking around this romantic trees and the Santa Monica little shops. And it was such a good night. And I saw things in the movie that I had never seen before because it was projected so huge.
Oh,
Like
wow.
behind him on the wall at the beginning is a painting of a dancer and she's arching her back. And then we see, Irene Jacob arching her back. It's just, you see like more of it the more you watch, which I love this movie. It's about coincidence, fate. There's a character of a judge. There's doppelgangers, there's doubles, there's questions of free will. Some people see the judge as a godlike figure. When I was in college, we did a unit on foreign film, and he chose this movie as one of the ones for philosophy, existentialism, free will, predestination. Like, what do you think? And he said he would get papers from everyone with different thoughts. Like, this guy is God. This guy is this. This is just about coincidence. She has totally free will. Things happen. And so, as long as you can back it up, everybody sees something different. So I love this movie. If you love it too, you should definitely check out, I think it's the most beautiful thing he ever wrote, Roger Ebert's review of it.
Oh wow.
Yeah, is just incredible. Yeah, it's my
Yeah,
favorite thing he wrote.
That's wonderful. I loved his reviews. I would always, whenever there was a movie that I really enjoyed, I would always go check out what he said about it because it would always give me some other dimension on it that I hadn't seen before.
Yeah, it was like romantic goosebumpy kind of writing, like, being in a cafe with people, maybe you've met them before, maybe you, and then it makes you want to run out in the street and, or talk passionately and desperately with whoever you're with, or it was so romantic and just, it was a
Oh.
beautiful piece.
That's wonderful. Yeah, this is a movie that really, like I was trying to write up my little plot summary of what
Oh
actually
my gosh, I
happens,
know.
and the best it was, I couldn't really figure out there's this movie is so, it's hard to define exactly what quote unquote happens because what actually happens is such a small part of the whole experience. And that, by the way, is my favorite thing in all of art, even in writing. Like I'm far less interested in plot than I am in voice, vibe, character, kind of the story beneath the story. And that's really what this movie is all in. Well, it's just a wonderful use of the medium because it's all in the visuals, in the pauses, in the conversations that these characters have with each other, even though nothing is really quote unquote happening. It's just riveting. And of course the, each of these movies focuses on a color. And much like in Minority Report, when I think about it, I think of how it looks,
No,
that
the
sort of washed out
visuals.
feel. This is when I think of this movie, I just see red everywhere. And just thinking about the meticulousness of what, how it must have been to put this movie together. Every scene has something in it that's red.
Yes,
And
and the right shade too, because there are
yeah.
so many different colors of in red, the family of colors. Yes, I know. It
Exactly.
has so many cool shots. I love the one where with the phone lines kind of going through the walls, because that's sort of a reddish or a brownish tint. There she's driving and you see the rear view mirror. I think there's a lot of magical shots. I love the one of the judge at the end with the glass that's a little bit cracked. Also, I noticed this time the use of like having characters above and below each other. They were never like climbing up a building to spy on a lover. You're at a different angle. She is a model and she's on a stage and he's in the audience, and there's constantly, it's, I don't know, what the significance is, but it's a film where there's a lot of echoes too, and people being like, she is unequivocally good, like you would say. And that kind of comes through. You can watch this movie alone, or you can watch it as part of the trilogy. At the end, there's like a little cameo of some of the characters, but also there's things that kind of pay off in this. Like there's an old woman who is always struggling to recycle a bottle in all three of them. And in the first one, Binoche's character doesn't see her. In the second movie, he's like so wrapped up in his own misery that he just ignores the old lady. And in this one, Irene Jacob goes over and does it for her. So it's kindness. Yes. And
Oh,
connection.
wonderful.
Yeah. It's about personal connection, which is really good.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing. I feel like that idea is at the heart of this movie. I haven't seen all three of them, so I wouldn't know about the interconnections, but this movie is really all about the echoes, the things that recur, the breaking glass, the relationship dynamics. There's two different sort of not abusive, but kind of unpleasant relationships going on in this movie that kind of mirror each other. Just all kinds of images that are just, you get the sense of this movie, in this movie, of everything kind of sort of circular, doing this sort of circular dance around itself and kind of echoing and coming back. And that's really sort of the driving force in this movie. It's, I feel like it's all, everything in this movie is sort of meticulously moving towards itself. That probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but it's, I feel like that's really the heart of this movie, is that all of these things really are random. There's really no
No, yeah, I know.
connection between them except the eye of the camera, the eye of the storyteller. They're choosing to show us particular things, and that's what sort of creates the meaning. I feel like that's exactly what I'm always trying to sort of hit on in my own work, and what I appreciate in other works, whether they're based on something else. This whole idea of The story and the storyteller kind of being the key, kind of creating the meaning. And I feel like this movie is really sort of a testament to that. That's why I found it so intriguing.
Yeah, because there's so many questions. Is he the younger character at a different point in his life? Is he him if he gets extremely bitter about like an unfaithful love? There's something where he abandons a dog and then there's an abandoned dog. So there, there's ways that it links up and also just shows you do have to make choices. She's in a relationship that's unpleasant with somebody who sounds like he's a little mentally unstable. And, as it continues, you do see it's sort of like you were saying, echoing and coming back, kind of like a boomerang, but the boomerang keeps changing and growing. There's a lot of, there's voyeurism in the film, but in interesting ways, because it's creepy at first. He's listening to the conversations. He was a judge of all of his neighbors. And he's just, because he had experiences where he didn't know if he actually committed the right thing with justice, this way he says he can hear the truth. And there's like, she wants people to know, but then does she? Then she kind of gets in on the story of maybe one of the neighbors is a heroin dealer. But then the judge actually writes, because of his interactions with her, writes letters and admits, yes, I was listening. And it forces things to come to light. So there's just so much to this movie. I feel like every time you watch it, you could hone in on something different. Yeah.
Yeah. There's just really, aside from sort of the central kind of cycle that all of these things are engaging in, there's this sort of beautiful meditation on not being able to judge anyone else's lives from the outside. This sort of idea of relativity. It's crucial that he is a judge. There's one moment
Yes.
when she asks him what he does, and he says with great importance, "I am a retired judge." Like, I don't do that anymore. I just kind of let things happen. I just observe. So
Yeah.
it's really interesting.
And it was a weird tie-in to The Gift. I mean, not really, but based on a script by Kieślowski, Tom Tykwer, who made Run Lola Run, was going to start his next trilogy, and he started it with Heaven, it's called. And it has Cate Blanchett and Giovanni Ribisi. So it kind of brings them back together, and that came out. Let's see, 2 years after The Gift. So if you're kind of watching it and you're getting into the characters or the actors in The Gift, and then you like this, see something else that Kieślowski wrote that was interpreted by a different filmmaker. Yeah,
Oh,
after he passed
wonderful.
away. Yeah, I haven't
Very
seen it
well.
since the theater, but I do remember I liked it. It wasn't, on par with Red, but I do remember it being good. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah,
Yeah.
are there any other movies or books or anything on the subject that you wanted to recommend or share?
Oh my gosh. Well, there was, I don't know, at one point we had been considering Only You. It would have been,
Yeah.
I was thinking it would have been nice to include a romantic comedy, but again, I couldn't really find enough to really dig into in
I
that one.
agree.
Although
Yeah.
that one does kind of take on the idea of predestination versus free will, although I feel like it doesn't really quite carry through. And I know we
Yes.
at some point mentioned this isn't a psychic movie, but we had talked about this terrible bummer of a movie, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which
Yeah,
is
I mean, a gorgeous film and so well done, but it's like you watch it and it's like, well, I'm depressed for a month. Yeah.
Oh, I
Do you
know, but
know,
it's a
oh my
really
gosh, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is
not at
crazy.
all.
I was taking my mom to see it and we stopped and got the mail because she loves Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet. We got the mail and her divorce papers came through that day. And so we just
Oh,
got
wow.
those. I mean, she initiated but then that's the movie. I just felt like I was the worst daughter in the world to bring her to that. So I don't think she's ever wanted to watch it again because, it does make you think about things and stuff. I've only seen it a few times myself. I think it's phenomenally well. I love Mark Ruffalo. I love the cast. But yeah, it's like, I don't know if I want to watch that around the holidays. Yes.
Yeah, it's not really the only reason I found it kind of interesting and relevant here is that it really takes sort of the it takes it sort of brings to light this idea of like what the question of what happens, what do you do in a romantic relationship when you know what the outcome is going to be? And it's just really interesting to me that they kind of they decide, like, again, they decide that the journey is the destination, and that's all, at the same time, so sad and so beautiful. And anyway, it's just an interesting take on that whole idea of predestination in romantic relationships.
Oh, that's a really good point. Did you see on Amazon Prime My Old Ass? I don't like the title, but did you see that?
No, I haven't. I'm intrigued now.
You have to. It's a coming of age about a young woman, and she encounters herself as an older woman, and she keeps telling her to steer clear of something because she knows what happens. I had talked about it on an episode of Watch with Jen with Jessica Ellis because it was on female sexuality and movies, and really liked it. I cried my head off. I did not. I'm like, my old ass, like I just started watching it thinking it was going to be just like super bad or something. And no, it wound up really hitting me kind of like, the same, oh, what is the one with Reese Witherspoon, The Man in the Moon, of all those movies from the 90s that we
Oh,
liked and
yeah.
Rich in Love. So yes, My Old Ass, I do recommend.
I'll write that down. My old ass.
Yes. On Prime. Yeah. But no, I think this was a really great selection and I love talking to you. You can come back anytime you want, come up with a new topic. But Lena,
Thank
thank
you.
you so much. I wish you a very happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and I wish you a happy holiday as well.
Yes,
This was
happy
wonderful.
holidays. I can't believe this year's flying by. Yep.
Oh, I know.
Yes.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as a dollar per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.